Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, educator, comedian, and activist Dr. Misha Mosley joins us to discuss educating Bay Area youth and adults about diversity and racial justice. In an age where white supremacists openly march in college towns, videos of police brutality against black and brown men abound in the media, and the president of the United States use racist and inflammatory rhetoric, many parents and educators are left struggling with what to say to our youth. Discussing race with our children or amongst ourselves can be uncomfortable, and many adults may want to avoid these conversations altogether. However, children notice differences between people at a very young age. In living in a society steeped in racism and bias, we cannot assume that avoiding these conversations will allow our children to become unbiased and inclusive. Tonight, we ask, how do adults come to terms with their own biases and fears about talking about race? And what should we when should we initiate these conversations with our children? And then what would we say? How do we explain prejudice and institutionalized racism to young children without confusing them, instilling fear, or potentially bias? And how are Bay Area schools and teachers addressing the issues, and how can they be allies to help parents navigate this terrain? Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues and more is comedian and educator Dr. Misha Mosley. Misha was the former head of the Social Studies Department at Thurgood Marshall Academic High School in San Francisco and is the founding executive director of the Black Teacher Project, an organization committed to recruiting, developing, and sustaining black teachers for schools in the United States. She also gives workshops on talking to kids about race. Welcome, Misha Mosley.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. You can dial 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Post a comment at the KLW website or, you know, post on our Facebook page. Many ways for you to join our conversation, this very important conversation tonight. So is it okay if I call you Misha?
Absolutely.
Misha, tell us how you began this work. How did you begin talking to parents about race and how to talk to their children about it?
Well, I was approached in the fall, the fall of 2015 by a collective of parents in San Francisco known as the Stay Woke Collective. They were parents who saw what was happening in the news, the news talking about the murders of black people across the United States by the police, and were troubled. How do I talk to my kids about what's happening? I can't avoid it. It's in the news. My kids have questions. I don't know what to say. And, I've done work over the years around racial equity in schools, predominantly with teachers, done some work around diversity and inclusion. That's what we call it now. It's not what we called it then, but, you know, it was primarily getting at the same core issues. And so this collective of parents asked me to put together a workshop for them and folks in San Francisco.
And who were these parents?
These were parents mostly of preschoolers, who I had connected with through some of my consulting work at the time, at some elementary school students. I would say most of the parents were interested in interrupting racism that they saw in their communities, mostly rooted in the mission, and really wanted some help, wanted some tools, some language.
And when you're talking about these parents, were they white, black, Latino, Asian? Who were they?
The parent who initially approached me is a black man, married to a white woman. And most of the parents in the collective were white parents, or parents who were in interracial relationships where at least one of the parents was white. And so as I've done these workshops over the years, particularly when it comes to parents, and I would say even for schools with teachers, most of the folks in the audience are white. I would say after that, probably the next largest racial demographic would be Asian.
And were you surprised to be approached by this group to do this? I mean, a lot of our conversation tonight, I think, will center around how many parents avoid the topic to begin with. What was it like for you for someone to reach out to you and talk to you about this?
It was really interesting. You know, I resisted at first. I said, I'm a teacher. I'm not a parent. I'm an auntie, not a parent. You sure you want me to do this work? And the person, Joel St. Julian, who I was speaking with, really appreciated my style of facilitation and my stance on particular issues, and felt and knew that there are many young people in my life who are, you know, now adults who I've known since before they were born. And while I don't have children of my own, I've had some of these conversations over the years with my friends' kids and my family members. And so when I thought about it, I thought about them. And I thought about how, in many ways, natural these conversations come to me because I am having them in my professional life. And what if I were that parent that wasn't having these conversations? And I recognize the importance of me not only doing this work inside of schools, but if I'm really to show up as a community member, as a Bay Area community member, I can't wait until a school system asks me to you know, share this information. And so it was an honor, and it was nerve-wracking at the same time.
And so who did you consider your audience, given that there was, it sounds like, a diverse group of people that were part of this collective? And when it comes to awareness of race and of racial bias, it usually falls along the lines of those who are privileged have the privilege of not mm-hmm. having to think about this.
Absolutely.
And those who are not privileged or oppressed are the ones who are constantly reminded of it. So right. So how did you navigate that terrain?
You know, for me, I thought about, you know, I asked a lot of questions about who would be there. In the beginning, we asked questions of folks who registered just to kind of get a gauge. And what I recognized was, and as I do these workshops now, I recognize that whoever shows up are the right people. And that I can't make assumptions about their experiences based on what they look like. You know, I can have some educated guesses, but there are plenty of folks of color who have been hurt by racism in ways that have allowed them to not have the same analysis that one would assume they would have because of the color of their skin. So, for example, if you are a black person who was bused to predominantly white schools as a child, was not... No, you know, in your household, you don't talk about race except that you have to be work twice as good to be seen as half as intelligent. There can be some messages that don't really allow for a critical analysis of race and racism. And so you may have incidents or experiences that you make sense of in ways that might be akin to someone who's white. And so what was important for me was that whoever was in that room had an opportunity to recognize you've got to deal with your own understanding of race before you talk to kids, whatever that is, whoever you are. But if you've never thought about it, it's time to start thinking about it.
So you walked into the room a mm-hmm. little apprehensive, but definitely energized to be taking this leap. What did you find?
I found a group of parents like most other parents who just love their kids and are terrified about the world we live in, and really have dreams of their kids living in a world where racism is not ripping through our communities in the ways that it is. I found parents who were all over the spectrum. Some had done what I call the base level 101 work, which looks like you've thought about race, you've had conversations about race, you've read about it, you've gotten some information about the connection between race and racism, that there is no such thing as race without racism. You have done some reflection on your own personal experience. Maybe you know a few buzzwords. But that you have a base level analysis. So those parents were in the room. There were also parents who had never thought about it, who had just seen all of this stuff in the news and were worried about their kids and what to say to them. And so my job was to structure a workshop, structure our time together in a way like I would my classrooms. You know, what happens when you have diverse learners? What happens when you have some students who are familiar with the material and some who are coming to it for the first time? So for me, I really think being able to approach it as the teacher that I'm used to being, which is listening and being responsive, but also being very clear about what I wanted folks to walk away with.
And how was it different to try to have these types of conversations or kind of map out your lesson plan, as it were, when you had adults in the room compared to when you were talking to kids about this or any other topic?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I started my career teaching high school. So high school history, nonetheless. So, you know, high schoolers are treated like adults often. You know, we forget that they're kids. And so there's a way that with my high schoolers, I was able to have real conversations about race and power. When it came to speaking to these parents, I recognized that, you know, many of them were maybe 10, 15, sometimes 20 years older than my former students. But I'd spent a lot of time in the adult education space in my work, primarily with teachers, and just recognizing that you have to meet people where they are. So if I'm talking to someone in their 20s, they're going to have a different analysis than someone in their 40s. The marked events of race in this country are different for them. Same would be true for boomers. So part of it is helping people recognize their own history. When I'm talking to teenagers, their history is a little bit shorter, right? So it might be stories from their family. But when I'm talking to adults, something happened to you. This may be the first time you're talking about race, but it's not the first time you felt race. It's not the first time you felt the impact of racism, whether you understood that that's what it was or not.
Hmm. And so how did that conversation evolve? What were some epiphanies for people? What were some places where people stumbled?
I would say the epiphanies for most were recognizing the subtle messages they got as a child about themselves, and for many of the white participants, about people of color. I heard story after story. You know, there's a part where I ask people to recount an early memory about race. And for most people, that memory was difficult or hard or painful. I don't set it up that way because some people may have memories about race that aren't that. But when people really dug deep, there's one story that stands out to me where a woman was sharing that she got into an elevator with her mother and was, you know, pressing the buttons, and an African-American man got into the elevator after them, and she felt her mother pull her purse close and pull her close. And she remembers being about 8 at the time. And she didn't really get it until that workshop, until she, you know, I asked her to think about it. And she said, she never said anything. She never said any words, but it was an instinct of what she felt like she had to do that stayed with her as a child. So she started to think about, what are the subtle things, what are the unconscious things I'm doing that are giving messages and lessons to my children that I don't even realize I'm doing? Because this is a parent who would say we're all equal.
Right, right. Know? And so that's a moment where people finally get to kind of integrate an experience that they hadn't had words for before and now understand something different. Where did people struggle?
I think people really struggled when we had to define who they are by race. So I ask everyone to introduce themselves, and including saying their race. And this was hard. So, you know, as a black person in the United States, I'm black all day. I'm blackity black black. Like, I just say I'm black. I'm proud to be black. I love being black. I can say that. White people, not as much, right? Particularly, this is 2015, right? So I think for a lot of folks, identifying their race is about checking a box. It's not about owning an identity when folks are white. And so standing up and saying, hi, my name is John, I'm white, was hard. People also stumbled, folks across the Asian community, whether you're talking about folks being South Asian or East Asian. Folks would say, I consider myself Chinese. Is that a race? I would check the box Asian, but I'm Indian and I don't have the same kind of experience as someone who's Filipino. So really drawing out the complexities of ethnicity and how that bumps up against our strict notions of race. So people struggled because they aren't used to being asked the question. And, you know, when we talk about race, people fill in other words. You know, they'll talk about their ethnicity or their religion or their culture. But to straight up have to stand up and declare your race was difficult for a lot of folks.
Hmm. So we've been spending, you know, the first 15 minutes of the program talking about adults, and then the show is about how to talk to kids. Mm-hmm. But it seems important to do this. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's obvious, but why is it important that we talk about adults when we're talking about children and learning about race?
it boils down to this. If we're trying to teach our kids something, we need to be clear about it, at least clear about what we're teaching them. And people want to jump to solutions. They want to jump to a script of what to say. But what you say to your child about race is no different than what you say to your child about anything else that's important. It's connected to your values. It's connected to what you believe, what you've experienced, how you see the world. It may be as open as, I want you to make your own decisions. But that's still taking a stance. What I would offer is most people in the Bay Area would claim to be or claim to aspire to be anti-racists. If you're going to say that you're an anti-racist, you should probably have a race analysis. And so talking with adults allows them the opportunity to get clear, because you have one. It just may be subtle or unclear. There's some way that you're making sense of race in the world. And so before you try to talk to kids in a way that may be more confusing to them, it's important that you're clear where you stand. So we have to start with the adults, because otherwise, what are we teaching the kids?
Hmm. And so what you just mentioned that keeps people from talking to their kids about race, or are there other things that get in the way? Is it this lack of self-awareness, mm-hmm. lack of just a kind of a worked through mm-hmm. analysis?
I think it's that's a core piece of it. I think the other piece is fear. We're afraid of getting it wrong. Everyone recognizes how high the stakes are in this country in particular. And so the idea that I might say something that's not quite right, that's not quite perfect, paralyzes folks. And it's, you know, often in this dominant culture way of living, perfectionism is a key piece. Like when we think about the hallmarks of white supremacy and how it shows up and how we organize ourselves, how we interact with one another, we always want to get it right, just right. There's no room for messiness. There's no room for, you know, figuring it out. You have to just give me the answer. Tell me what to say. And so the fear of not having that clarity or the fear of getting it wrong gets in people's way. And quite frankly, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, it's a privilege, because for many of our parents of color, I have to have some version of a conversation with you way before I feel comfortable, way before I feel super clear, because it's a difference between you coming home or not as a child. I have to teach you how to behave in this new world that may be different than the one I grew up in. Many of the parents in my life didn't grow up in as diverse a community as their children are exposed to now. And so what it means to have friends of different races and to go play and what's going to happen on the playground is different than what they experienced, or they had a painful and confusing experience as a child and never had the chance to work through it or think through it. So that fear, I think, is one of the most important factors. And we don't have time to be afraid, folks. Not in 2018. We got to push through it.
And, you know, often people talk about how, you know, the Bay Area has progressive values, and one could say there's a veneer of that, and below that, there's quite a bit of bias and exclusion. How does being a parent here in the Bay Area sort of help or hinder a parent's process of trying to do some self-reflection and trying to open up dialogue with their child around issues of race and racial injustice?
Well, you know, I mean, it's the Bay Area, so we love to reflect. Let's be clear. Come on. I think, you know, part of the challenge is just that. We have a reputation of really having these values that are super clear, that are super on the edge. And I think being in a context where you may or may not take the opportunity to do that reflection hinders folks, because it's sort of, you know, I started and finished my PhD at Cal and go Bears. And I often say that, you know, we think of ourselves as activists by tuition. You go to UC Berkeley, therefore you're an activist. I think you live in the Bay Area, therefore you're reflective, therefore you're progressive. When folks haven't always put in the work to really have the feelings, you know, and make meaning of what's happening in the world. So I think it helps in that there are tons of spaces to do that work in a way that there aren't always in other communities.
And how is the skyrocketing cost of living, the widening divide of income and wealth and gentrification, how is that setting up the stage for these types of conversations?
Well, it's complicating them for sure. I would say more and more, and I'm a transplant, so I want to be clear. I've got nothing against folks who moved to the Bay Area from someplace else. I'm one of those people. I do think that with a new wave of folks coming in through gentrification, through the tech industry in particular, where these issues are really emergent in terms of people addressing them. They've been around for a while, but in terms of folks addressing them, it's a challenge because you have a lot of new money. You have a lot of senses of entitlement. I was asking my partner, she went into a cafe, and she said, it's a hipster cafe. I said, well, how do you know? She's like, there's just an air of self-importance that was overwhelming and ruined my beverage. And so, you know, you see that in the communities that are moving to the Bay now, along with the rhetoric of being progressive. And when I moved here in the mid-90s, there was still a sense of you had to do something. We couldn't just click a button. We had to show up somewhere and have a conversation in person with folks. And I think that that makes a difference. So as we look at how gentrification is impacting our communities, you know, I think about if you're going to move into a neighborhood, who are you pushing out and what are you doing to keep the people who are still there? So how do you think about your responsibility relative to race and power? So if you are a white gentrifier, if you are a gentrifier of color, how do you recognize your responsibility to maintain the racial culture of the community that you're moving in? It's not simply about having the politics and not paying attention to who used to live in the home before you or what's happening in the school that your kid could go to but is not good enough for your kid, so you're not going to send them there. How are you helping to make that school better? How are you using your resources to make sure that the young people in your community have jobs? So there are things that people can do when they're moving to really think about how racial justice can operate in the communities that they're moving in. But if you're just waiting for it to flip, if you're just waiting for the next coffee shop or the next doggy daycare and you're not looking at what's happening or talking to people who you pass on the street, you're part of the problem.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we are discussing educating Bay Area youth, but for the last 20 minutes we've been talking about educating adults about diversity and racial justice with our guest, Dr. Misha Mosley, a Bay Area comedian, educator, and founding executive director of the Black Theater Project. I want to say theater. I don't know why.
Maybe in the future. I'm busy right now with the Black Teacher Project. But who knows? There's probably a Black Theater Project out there already, though.
Black Teacher Project. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Let's talk about it. How have you talked to your kids about race? How do those conversations go? Or why haven't you? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment at KALW's website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So let's shift to talking about to kids. So help us understand how kids experience race. How early does it start? And what are their brains doing when they are experiencing or noticing race?
I mean, it starts as early as they begin to interact with other people, you know, particularly outside of their families. Kids notice difference. One of the earliest manifestations has to do with skin color. So when I talk to parents of really young kids, I would say overarching, no matter how old your kids are, the most important thing to do is listen. Pay attention and listen to your children. We're very quick to talk to them. How do we talk to kids about race? We listen to them. And so, you know, you'll have a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old when they're really creating vocabulary and they're pointing things out and they're noticing things. It's often the age where it's like, don't say that. Don't say that that person's this color or that color, but they're making meaning. And it's our discomfort that confuses them. So as young as that age, you can start talking to kids about race.
Because they haven't ascribed values to those
exactly.
things.
Yeah. They're noticing that this person looks different. They're noticing that there's something going on. And they're noticing that you're acting funny. And they're trying to understand why. Because you're teaching them some basic things at that age. At every age, we're teaching them basic values. And race becomes attached to that, whether we're conscious of it or not.
And so how old would you say?
2.
2. Wow, that's pretty young. What do you do? Do you wait for the child to kind of make an observation? Do you talk to the child at some earlier stage? I can imagine people could really be tying themselves in knots about, like, how do you do it? When do you do it?
Yeah.
Like,
well, so part of it is demystifying the it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things I talk about in the workshop is when we're thinking about issues of race, we need to think about them the way we think about anything else. What are the core values we're teaching our kids at different stages of their development? So if we're teaching them love, if we're teaching them patience, if, you know, we're teaching them how to be nice, how to be kind, we attach those things to race. So we're reading books to our kids, I hope, pretty early on. What books are you reading them? By 2, your children have probably been in front of a screen. What's on the screen? Who's on the screen? So there are ways that we're teaching them about race that aren't about this let me sit you down and have a conversation about race talks. There are the subtle ways. So when we have imagery that is reflective of racial diversity, that's how we start. So that might be the books, that might be the dolls, that might be, the videos that you thinking about what are the learning mechanisms, because we're always so eager to teach our kids as soon as they're able to learn something. I got to teach them, you know, sight words and alphabets and all of these things that we want them to know. All of that can be done through the lens of racial justice and racial equity. So it doesn't have to be this big separate conversation. But if you're clear about your stance, you're going to notice, all of the people in that particular cartoon are this race or that race, or they not talking about it at all. I wonder if there is something that could teach the alphabet while teaching social justice, right? In the Bay Area, we know those books. How do we see them relative to race?
And so what it sounds like is that this awareness that an adulthood would have cultivated then becomes part and parcel of the lessons and the observations that the links they're making for their child when it comes to everyday experiences.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the key, is to be so comfortable talking about race with adults that when it comes to speaking with your child, it's a natural flow of how you are and what you do. You know, I think about it and talk about it in the workshop relative to the birds and bees conversation, right? We have some sense that
it's funny that we still call it the birds and the bees in 2018, by the way.
You know what I mean? And I'm just pretty
talking
sure.
about another topic that people feel uncomfortable talking about.
And I've been really, I really want to know the origin of that, because what I recall from birds and bees. Anyway, but the idea that we have a sense that there are messages that we want to teach our children. Even now, we see more and more with the Me Too movement and this unpacking these ideas of masculinity, right? This idea that now we're focused on clear messages that we want to teach young children about safety, about appreciation, about respect. That's age appropriate. Same thing is true when it comes to race. And so because we are uncomfortable with race, because many people are, it feels like it's this whole big, bad other thing, when in fact the idea of talking about an issue that has to do with identity and power, we've already got some of that laid out. The key is, how clear are you? So I'll know if I'm talking to, you know, my nephew who's mixed, black and Latinx, I know what I'm going to talk to him about, because I know I'm talking to him about his family. I'm talking to him about his grandparents. Mm-hmm. So there's a way that in naturally speaking about who we're going to visit, what we might see, what we might eat, how we might be treated, that you're preparing, right? When kids have questions, that you're answering them honestly, and not fearing the question.
Right. Because it sounds like the default is to defer. Yeah. The conversation. And what are the risks, or what are the unintended consequences of deferring these types of discussions?
That you're leaving it up to someone else, because kids will learn about race. They are learning about race. They're learning from the media. They're learning from the interactions that they're having that they're not even telling you about. So you think about our own childhood. What did we tell our parents? And then all the things that we didn't tell them. The same thing is happening. So the longer you decide they're not ready, it's important to recognize it means that you're not ready. They're ready. They're as ready as they have to be. So, you know, I think about Tamir Rice, who certainly wasn't ready to die, and the conversation that his classmates, parents, you know, there are conversations that have happened since his death. You know, you think as far back as Emmett Till, the conversations that were happening. These are young boys. So when I hear parents say, well, you know, they're so young, they're not ready, I'm like, wow, it must be a nice world to live in where you can just decide you're going to wait until they're 10 or 12 to talk to them about race. So many people in my community don't have that option.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing educating Bay Area youth and adults about diversity and racial justice with our guests, Misha Mosley. She's a Bay Area comedian. We haven't talked about your comedy, but maybe some other time. Educator and founding executive director of Here Comes the Black Teacher Project. I got it right
there
this time. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, tweet us at cityvisionsklw, or post a comment at the KLW website. So, you mentioned age appropriateness. Mm-hmm. How do you craft a message that's going to match what a child can work with? And this goes to an email we got from Meg. Meg states, I've been using books to discuss race with my young preschool age child. Many of the books we've read have to do with slavery, and I'm worried that I'm introducing bias. When are children able to understand slavery and its repercussions? Are there issues with introducing this topic matter too early?
It's a great question. I would say first, you know, let's unpack this idea of bias, right? So when we think about bias, is we all are involved in it, right? So there are ways that we want to be really clear about what the message is. So I'm going to be biased in how I talk to the young people in my life because I have an anti-racist stance. I've got no problem with that, right? But I am going to unpack some things in more detail. So when it comes to slavery, it's all about context. If the only time you're talking about black people to a young child is telling the story of slavery, that's the issue. It's not that you don't want to tell them about slavery. It's that how you're contextualizing that. So, for example, you can contextualize that relative to how we all got here. Different people got here different ways. Do you know the story of how your own family got here? How did other people's family get here? What were their experiences? So the harsh brutality of slavery, are you going to sit your five-year-old down and show them 12 years a slave? Maybe not. Is it the three-year-old that's going to run through Roots all of the episodes? Probably not, right? But there are ways that we can talk about the injustices that have happened in our country in a way that I would hope everyone's raising their children to be anti-racists. So helping them understand how we got to this country and why things are the way they are. So at that age, you're talking about good and bad. You're talking about right and wrong. You're not getting into the deep levels of complexity. So again, I say go back to what are those core values that you're teaching and how do you connect and root the stories to those? As your children get older, the analysis gets more complex. But it doesn't mean that you don't have an analysis with young children, because we always do. We're just conscious of it or not.
Mm. So this is a tweet that we received from, not sure if I'm going to pronounce this handle correctly, Jamoki or Jamoke, I'm not sure, in Oakland. And this question is, when is it appropriate to speak about intersectionality? Now, how many adults know what intersectionality is?
Right,
or how many white
right.
adults know what
exactly.
intersectionality means? How do you bring it up with your child?
Right. And I think that might be Jamoke.
Okay.
And, you know, I think part of it is how you talk to young people about the multiple ways.
So I'm going to pause and yeah. I'm going to have you help define intersectionality.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about there's a specific term and then there's a general term. When you're talking about the specific term of intersectionality, when you're talking about, particularly when it comes to Black women, the intersection of race and gender and the particular ways that Black women move through the world in terms of how the phrase was developed and coined, right? The multiple and intersecting oppressions that Black women face in our identities. It has been attached to the idea of intersecting identities, meaning I'm talking about race and class. I'm talking about age and income, that there are ways that we think about who we are beyond one particular demographic, but multiple demographics. When we're talking about the phrase intersectionality specifically, there's an analysis of power around a particular group of people. But it's been used to talk more broadly about how power and systemic oppression work on multiple levels. So that's a lot for a young person, right? But if I'm starting with a foundational understanding of power, which I always am, if you're teaching your kids, stay in school, go to college so that you can do X, Y, and Z, you're teaching them about power. You're teaching them a particular value. If you're saying your goal is to be rich and wealthy so that you can do whatever you want to do, you're teaching them about capitalism and power. Like, there are subtle messages that we don't always connect to these larger pieces, but they're ever present. So when we think about the complexities of identity in the Bay Area, I mean, you think about LGBTQ communities in particular, who we all are, right? In walking down streets, thinking about who you see, thinking about what's that flag versus that flag, there are opportunities to have those layered conversations with young people. But it's got to start from you. Who are you? Before we start trying to explain who everybody else is, let's get clear about who we are. What are our intersecting identities? How do they work together? How does a young person get to understand what that means for themselves so that they can see the impact on other people?
So I might imagine that even with these excellent points that you're making, people feel still like, wow, the terrain is fraught with danger, that I'm going to be clumsy and that I'm going to trip over myself. How much harm can a parent do in talking to their child about these types of topics if they're not fully aware of themselves and their own bias or don't quite know how to talk about it?
Lots of harm. I mean, what's true is parents can do lots of harm when they are clear, depending on what they're clear about, right? And we've seen, unfortunately, more of the manifestations of that in recent months. But I think part of the way you can mitigate some of that harm, even in your lack of clarity. So say you're someone who's just beginning the journey. You're like, whoa, I'm just starting to think about this, and my kid's 10, and they're coming home with questions that I wasn't ready for. You know, I think it's Pema Chodron has a book that says Start Where You Are, right? Just begin the journey. And depending on how old your child is, you may begin the journey with your child, and that's okay. But we have to get out of this idea that we have to be perfect before we can bring it to our children, right? I will say that we have a greater responsibility to be better prepared. So if you're still figuring it out, if you're confused, be upfront about that. and take it on. I mean, now this is a new family dinner conversation. We're going to make meaning of these things together. There's a vulnerability that's necessary when it comes to parenting children in the 21st century. There was a time when, as parents, folks could just make stuff up. And as a kid, you wouldn't know. But now kids can find the answers to questions before you even finish thinking about what you might think about it. So if we're confused, it's okay to say that. It's okay to have this be a learning journey together. And remember, like, it's about the experience of learning. I mean, I say this to teachers all the time. The information is up for grabs now. So the cat's out of the bag. We're no longer the holders of information. Young people can access it without adults. So what is our responsibility? What is ours to do in this version of the information age? It's to be human and to be real and to teach our young people how to be human. And that means we got to relate to and understand power differently.
And what happens, or how do we respond when our children unintentionally say something offensive or biased, you know, perhaps in the privacy of one's own home, but perhaps not out mm-hmm. and about? How would you direct parents or advise parents to respond to those situations?
First, take a deep breath. Breathing's always good. Think about, you know, often when that happens, parents get triggered. And so this is where I think about the work of Kathy O'Bear around navigating triggers. We have to understand, if a young person says something that we think is offensive and we're mortified, my kid just said that, I'm like at a high level trigger, right? I'm freaking out because my kid said that. What's that about for me? Because it's about something old. It's about some fear of my kid being called racist or being seen as racist that comes back to something else, right? Remember that they're children and that they're on a learning path, and practice compassion and ask questions. So before you admonish, don't say that. Before you admonish them and make them wrong, understand what made them say that. If they say a word that you're like, where'd you hear that word? Where'd you learn that word? Helping to get information so that you can buy yourself a little time often, but also think about what you want your response to be. Because simply telling them that they're wrong, particularly if you're embarrassed, so now you feel shame, you've passed the shame on to them, and people still are unclear as to what's going on and what's wrong. So asking questions, getting information, and again, when you're clear about your stance, you know what happens when your kids say something that's incorrect. You know how you correct them. But if you're unclear, if you're just triggered because they said something controversial or inappropriate, then you don't have the opportunity to actually teach them with love and compassion. You're punishing them for your embarrassment. And that's about you. That's not about them.
We have an interesting email that sort of gets to the other side of this, which is, we've been talking about how you address these issues with your children. What if it's another person's child? So we have this email from Karishma. In the email it says, in 2014, I babysat for an affluent, quote-unquote, progressive white family in the Outer Richmond neighborhood of San Francisco. They had a 5-year-old girl and a 2-year-old boy. One night as I was bathing them, the 2-year-old said, "You're yucky. Your skin looks like poop." I didn't quite know what to do, so I explained why my skin was brown, my Indian heritage. That was the last time I babysat for them. I went back and forth about whether to tell his parents. I never did. 4 years later, is it too late?
Wow. Okay. So my first instinct is, no, it's not too late. It's never too late. I would say it's about context and how, right? And thinking about the why. So for me, the reason why I say it's not too late is, you know, you were in a position to care for someone's child. That's one of the greatest responsibilities. Who knows how that child has grown up in those last 4 years, what they've been exposed to? What I will say about my knowledge of that area is that it's not the most racially diverse place in San Francisco. And so if there are not a lot of dark-skinned people in that child's personal life, that comment turns into something else as they get older, right? So being able to follow up with the parents, talk about the impact that it had, and talk about what you hope and want for their child, because they may not be thinking about it. And again, at that age, they're noticing difference. And so they're going to say something like that that's really offensive and not okay. How you address it years later is about really doing some of that healing. And hopefully having an impact on that child. You never know. I mean, you can reach out. The parents are going to do with it what they will. But I think too often as people of color, we are harmed by things that white people say and do, that our own confusion in the moment about how to respond means that we hold on to it. So now that's more of what we're holding in terms of negativity of the impact of racism, and there's no outlet, right? It adds up. And so then that child just gets to go on, and there's a reason, there's an opportunity that you have. There's a reason why you were there and that happened, I believe. And so really taking advantage of that opportunity, even if there's been some time.
So we have about maybe less than 15 minutes in our program, and I want to turn next to schools and how schools can help be a resource for parents and in bringing this conversation to the fore and helping parents to feel comfortable with their own racial identity and their and helping them formulate their racial analysis, as you call it, and then talking to their children in age-appropriate ways that are constructive. So where are we in the Bay Area when it comes to this type of topic? We have actually an email here from Joshua that says, do our school districts have curriculum to address diversity and racial justice yet? And if not, when? So first of all, what's already happening in our schools?
Right. Well, I think that there are a number of things that are happening. I think it depends on the district and it depends on the school in terms of what's done with Fidelity. So there's tons of information out there. You know, when you get to the higher grades, secondary level, high school, middle school, you'll have more opportunity to learn about identity. There are identity classes. There are classes that, particularly when you move to social justice-focused schools, that are really taking these issues on. So Everett Middle School in San Francisco is one of the schools I've had the pleasure of working a great deal with. And they're constantly unpacking as adults on campus who they are, what it means for them to work in the racialized bodies that they're working in. And as the mission becomes more and more gentrified and they watch their student population shift, how they respond to student needs and more parent demands, right? So that sense of entitlement starts to creep in. So how do they deal with that and still serve the students who they have been serving for so many years when there's a different sense of who the school belongs to? And a lot of that is educating the young people and helping them make sense of race and racism and differences in power. So there's curriculum out there. There are teachers who are actually doing this work through the standards, through looking at opportunities to make sure that students are passing these ridiculous exams and doing what they need to do by making it culturally relevant and culturally responsive. Part of what that means is naming race, naming power. So much of it is often up to the individual teacher. Part of why I started the Black Teacher Project was to make sure that Black teachers have a space in schools where we are bringing our full selves. We're bringing the truth of the history of race and racism in this country, even when we're teaching physics, even when we're teaching kindergartners. Not with a particular, you must know all of these things by the age of seven agenda, but a recognition that Black people in this country have a lot to offer. And as we've been pushed out of schools and education, we've lost the opportunity to really deal with a lot of these issues head on and actually work side by side with parents to help their young people be able to have an anti-racist stance. So I think about that person who emailed in about the incident with the young person. I think about how many stories I've heard like that from teachers or parents pulling their kids out of a Black teacher's class because they don't want them taught by a Black teacher. This is, you know, in two of the cases happening from Latino parents. So when we think about race, it's also important for us to take it beyond a Black-white issue, but to recognize the complexity of how racism has harmed all of us and how these dichotomies of white people and people of color, it's much more complex. So when we think about what's happening in schools, one of the most important agents to really consider agents of change are our teachers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we believe that, Black teachers have been and will continue to be at the forefront of that work.
And my understanding is that Black teachers leave the profession at much higher rates
yes.
Than non-Black teachers.
Yes.
And is it because of situations like that? Are there other structural factors? Say more.
It's a combination of factors. I mean, you are recruiting people into spaces where we are expected to do so much more that isn't talked about. And this is true for teachers of color broadly, where we're expected to men are expected to be disciplinarians, women are expected to be mothers. We're expected to teach remedial classes. Our Black administrators are put in positions mostly to deal with operations, rarely to deal with instruction, particularly when it comes to Black men. So there are these ways that Black bodies have been racialized in schools where Black teachers are in charge of taking care of the Black kids and keeping them under control, and not actually tapped for our academic expertise, not tapped for our community knowledge and connections. I will say more and more, Black teachers who are moving to urban areas aren't having the opportunities to actually stay connected with multiple communities, and particularly with Black communities, because Black communities are getting pushed out of the Bay Area. So part of what pushes Black teachers out are these expectations, along with the lack of recognition, along with the racialized macro and microaggressions that happen across the school day from young people and adults, with pretty much no recognition that these are the dynamics that are happening. And so what we seek to do is to make sure that Black teachers have an analysis around what's happening, but also have some skills in navigating the triggers, are put in a position to actually be able to do well on the exams that they need to do to continue to teach, even though those exams were created after Brown versus the Board of Ed to keep Black teachers out of the classroom.
And it just so happens, and I'm not sure that this is a coincidence, but perhaps it is, that at this very moment, both the Oakland Unified School District and the San Francisco Unified School District are headed by two Black African-American educators, Oakland by Kyla Johnson Trammell and San Francisco by Vincent Matthews. What do you see in the potential that you see in their leadership at this time in the Bay Area?
I see great potential. I see an opportunity for folks to be able to really name racial equity as a priority and pull on the resources that are here, whether you're talking about San Francisco Coalition of Essential Small Schools, National Equity Project, the Black Teacher Project. There are tons of organizations that are in local to the Bay Area that are really trying to address racial justice and racial equity in schools from a systemic level as well as an instructional level. So
what would be a difference between instructional versus systemic?
Fair enough. So when we're talking about instruction, often we're looking at the curriculum, what we're teaching, and the pedagogy, how we're teaching it. So with the Black Teacher Project, we care about who's doing those things because that it connects, right? So it's not simply that I'm teaching this book and I am absent from being connected to the book as a Black teacher. What it means for me to teach Shakespeare or Beloved or any of those things makes a difference. When we're talking about the systemic issues, we're looking at where does the money go? I mean, let's be clear. Oakland is in a budget crisis. That's another story for another time. San Francisco has more resources, but it's still, you know, it's public education. So how do we make decisions about where money goes relative to equity, not equality, not everyone getting the same, but equity, people getting what they need? How do we undo some of the harm that's been done? So when we look at how Black communities are being pushed out of San Francisco and the greater Bay Area, for the folks who were actually able to stay, what's needed for students to be successful when many of the foundations, many of the neighborhoods, that family house, the things that stabilized communities are gone? What is the responsibility of schools and teachers in this day and age? And I think that these two superintendents really have the opportunity to lift some of those issues up. I think as Black leaders, they have the opportunity to heal this Black-Brown divide that I've noticed as a New Yorker coming to California. I'm used to Black people being Afro-Latinx and speaking Spanish. People is, I'm relatively dark. People as dark as me speaking Spanish. I come out here, and there seems to be this divide between Black and Latinx, Chicano, Mexican folks. And I'm like, I know some of the origins, but I think these two superintendents have an opportunity to heal some of that divide. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, I hope that they can get some of the money that's coming in from the tech industries and actually get that rerouted to schools, because it's more than a Google bus.
I thought you were also going to talk about disciplinary philosophy in schools, which tend to be much harsher and punitive towards students of color than non-students of color.
Absolutely. And I would expect that they would
or
be
students of non.
Black and brown students. Black and Latinx kids are disproportionately sent to suspension. They're disproportionately referred to special education without those resources. So again, it's really looking at where is the money going, where are the supports going, and having leaders who can actually name some of those things and do something about it. Right.
So let's bring it back to the parents. Yep. How does this context of trying to support and increase the numbers of Black teachers in our schools, having leaders that are bringing these issues to the fore and are trying to reroute the resources, how does this fit back to our original topic of how to help parents engage in this with their children?
It's that parents should not feel like they're doing this alone. The parents have the opportunity to work with schools, with teachers, with school leaders to actually construct and be a part of an anti-racist community. So I keep going back to that, because talking to your kids about race, in my opinion, has to come from an anti-racist stance. It's not just speaking philosophically about this social construct of race. It is, hey, young person that I love, we want you to build a world and be a part of a world that's dismantling what has been built, that is fighting against the systems and behaviors and language that perpetuate racism. So that parents recognize, when you send your kid to school, ask questions. So ask if the adults on campus are talking about race. If they're not talking about race as adults, how are they going to be prepared to talk to your children about it? What message is the message that your child is getting in school? Is that consistent with what you're giving at home? So really beginning those racialized dialogues between parents and teachers and
so
school leaders.
There's help out there.
Absolutely.
And so one thing you're pessimistic about and one thing you're optimistic about when it comes to this topic.
I am pessimistic in that I believe that folks will take their own comfort that people's comfort will be more important than justice. So I feel a little pessimistic about that, just seeing how comfortable we're trying to be all of the time, everywhere. You know, even today, it's like, oh, it's raining. It's just rain. Just rain. Get an umbrella. Keep going where you're going, right? But sometimes people are, their fear and discomfort. I'm pessimistic a little bit about that for some folks, particularly people who are climbing from that middle class to upper middle class rung. There's a little disconnect where money comes in. And, you know, I would say I'm hopeful in that we're still the Bay Area, that there are still the seeds and the core of progressivism, of fighting the systems that have been oppressing people since this country was founded. I believe that this is one of the most important places to be to do this work, and that there are enough folks who are here that will continue to stay vocal and hold one another accountable and support one another. It's not just about calling people out. It's about support as well.
So where can people learn more about the work you do, both in giving workshops and also about the Black Teacher Project?
So you can go to MishaMosley.com. That's MishaMosley.com. And the Black Teacher or BlackTeacherProject.org, BlackTeacherProject.org, to find out about more information about our work there.
Great. And we'll post those links on our website as well. So I want to thank you, Misha Mosley, for a very informative and engaging hour as we talk about talking to our children about race and racial justice. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David Latulippe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next Monday for a discussion about how genetics affects our health in so many ways, including our weight. This is Joseph Pace. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.